listen stoically where we try to be involved, to listen and learn for us all to evolve. So welcome to you and welcome the world. We hope you enjoy the stories to be told.
Welcome to Stoically, a podcast where we explore environmental conservation, our human mindset and adventure. Each week we invite you into a conversation with people from all walks of life, people who truly inspire us and set about contributing to a greater place for us all to call home. So please take some time to settle in for a conversation today with our host, Mayo.
Hi everyone, and welcome to the Stoically podcast. My name's Mayo Backhausen, and we are on a mission to maintain the art of conversation, holding space to converse and share stories on adventure, mindset, and our natural world. I hope you're as motivated and inspired coming out of these conversations as I am, and I hope it leads you to start, sit, or listen in conversation. We invite you to join us in acknowledging the traditional custodians upon the lands where this podcast is created and listened to, and pay our respects to their elders, past, present, and emerging. On this episode, I have the great pleasure of speaking with Alice Forrest, who is a conservationist and marine biologist. She drops facts like penguins drop poop, and her passion for the natural world and the creatures who inhabit it has led to a range of incredible adventures, from studying blue whales in the Indian Ocean to seabirds and plastic on remote islands. She holds a degree in biodiversity and conservation, as well as marine and Antarctic science. Alice is pushing the message that plastic is not okay, and her downloadable book, Microplastics, Massive Problem, is just one example of her putting her passion and love for the natural world into action. And that book is available on her website, aliceforrest.com, and you can download it from there. Just a forewarning, this episode requires a notebook, and it is just jam-packed full of facts, and it's just a lot of fun. So thanks so much for joining in. Thanks for your time and your energy today. Now let's get into it. Hey, so Alice, thanks so much for joining me on the Stoically podcast today. I hope you're doing well.
I'm doing great. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, no, it's a real pleasure. And I just know that your personality and the work that you do and the work that you've done is a real positive force in the world. So it's so great to be able to introduce you to a whole nother community of people.
Right back at you. Totally inspired by all the things you've done as well.
Working at it, hey. I think we're all working towards a pretty big goal, pretty lofty goal. Hey, yeah. I just thought, how about we start off with this one question I had, and that was what makes you think that this world is an awesome and amazing place?
Oh, such a good question. So many things. The ocean is the first thing that comes to mind. So many ways to go with this. I feel like just everything, like every little thing in existence convinces me that it's an amazing world, just the way the whole planet functions at a fundamental level, like us breathing out, the plants taking that in and then giving us back what we need, and this whole beautiful balance that we live in. I think the oceans and all the life that exists in there, though, is probably the main thing that gets me really stoked on the planet. The ocean wildlife, all of the amazing animals, getting the chance to meet those animals, and then also the way the ocean sustains us as well. Just, it's so mind-blowing to think that two-thirds of the breath we're taking are tiny little plants in the ocean that are making that air for us and keeping our planet at a temperature that is perfect for us to live here and creating this beautiful atmosphere. It's just, we're so lucky to live on such an amazing planet. And so many crazy things have to happen to get us here. So many weird quirks of evolution. It's wild.
Hey, this is the most, I'm looking forward to this the most, you just dropping all these facts and like amazing gold nuggets. So you just said that two-thirds of the air we're breathing comes from plants in the sea?
Yeah, the forests are pretty cool, but the ocean's where it's at. Most of the air we're breathing is coming from the ocean and not from the land.
Wow.
Although, Tarkin, all the forests feel very important, but, yeah, the phytoplankton. So you've probably heard of plankton, which basically just means anything that floats. So it comes from the Greek word for drifter, which I kind of love, or wanderer. So that's it, all those little things just drifting, wandering around the ocean. And a lot of those are tiny single-celled plants, which photosynthesize just like plants on land. But if you zoom in on them, they're unbelievable. I don't know if you've ever Googled like the skeleton of a diatom or what else, Radiolaria. There's all these amazing little tiny single-celled animals, but some of them build their skeletons out of silica. So they literally live in little glass houses essentially, but have these really intricate structures. Some of them use calcium, but same, they build like tiny little stars or spirals or just the most incredible shapes you've ever seen, but they're single-celled. We can't see them with the naked eye and they're making the air that we breathe. That alone is enough reason that the ocean is the coolest thing that has ever existed.
I totally agree. Hey, so we've got to Google what?
So there's basically, if you Google diatoms, is a good place to start. The best place to start. Look that up. But also there was an amazing artist, I believe in the 18th century, but don't quote me on that. And his name is Ernst Haeckel, H-A-E-C-K-E-L. And he was a German illustrator, but also a scientist. And he was the first person to look at those animals or plants, the tiny single-celled plankton, and draw them. So he has a whole book with the most amazing images you've ever seen of all the tiny little skeletons of those animals.
Oh, wow. Unreal.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's so sweet. Oh, also, and if you could start this trend, that would be sweet. So a friend of mine came up to me the other day, and you know how there's that search engine, I think it's called Google, and it's really mm-hmm. big, but there's also a number of other search engines that once you search on them, they like plant trees if you search, and one's called yeah. Ecosia. You know that
Brilliant.
One?
Brilliant.
Yeah. So yeah. like... So we were thinking, wow, wouldn't it be amazing if we could, instead of saying, oh, go and Google this, or I Googled it, you say, oh, I Ecosia'd it, or I go and Ecosia it. And we got rid of that Google word. And
it doesn't roll off the tongue quite as nicely, but I see what you're working at. I feel like we could make it happen.
Yeah. So we need to maybe, Ecode it. Yeah. But so by way of introduction to the rest of the world right now via the podcast, we're just trying to set that trend.
Or, I love it. I will start doing it. And I feel like at the very least, it's a good conversation starter. People will be like, what are you trying to say?
Yeah.
And then you can tell them all about Ecosia and planting trees.
Yeah. And then the best thing you've ever Googled, far out, I just stuffed it up. The best thing you've ever searched on Ecosia for is single-celled plants. Go check it out.
Yeah. Wicked. Totally. Definitely do. They're amazing.
All right. Yeah, sweet. And so that's amazing. I'm so stoked we've already been able to uncover something that's probably going to... So that has got to be a pretty big black hole of searching down the interwebs, right? Like your...
Oh, it really is.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I recently did a series of workshops in Byron, where I'm from, on like ocean... microbiology, just ocean in general, basically an art. So I've partnered up with a local artist who does really amazing like sacred geometry. So just using a compass and a ruler and drawing different shapes and then creating different forms. And so I did a whole presentation on the wonder of the ocean and different structures in the ocean. So different types of symmetry and different types of skeletons and why they evolved all these different structures. And then she showed people how to draw them using a compass. And it was such a black hole. Once I started researching for that presentation, the things I found were unbelievable. The one that springs to mind right now, which is the least scientific but the most adorable, was sea urchins, the little spiky guys that live in the rock pool. There's studies basically showing that they collect random shells and things from the ocean and they put them on top of their heads, I guess, or all around them to stop other animals from eating them. So they make a little shield, basically. And someone somewhere in the world discovered this and they had sea urchins in their fish tank. So they 3D printed tiny little hats, like little Viking hats, a little Harry Potter witch's hat, little cowboy hats, and they just left them scattered around their tank and the urchins went and collected them and put them on their heads. And it's one of the best things I've seen on the internet.
Oh, my God.
So Ecosia it. Definitely Ecosia it.
Ecosia the shit out of that. That sounds so funny.
Yeah.
Good. So, yeah. I mean, that brings me to a great question. I'm pumping up my own questions here, but workshops, community workshops, what was the reason for putting that on? What do you hope to gain from that?
Good question. So I think for me, coming from a background of doing science and research and learning about particularly plastic pollution in the ocean, that was the main thing I studied. It was very eye-opening, often very depressing, and it often felt like I was just like shouting and no one was listening. And then I kind of had this realization, mostly through personal things in my own life, so spending time doing different conservation projects. Long story short, I went to Japan to the Cove where they do that dolphin slaughter. I don't know if you've seen that documentary. So I went there with Sea Shepherd, saw some of the most horrific things I've ever seen. And then the following year I went to Tonga and I swam with the humpback whales in the wild in Tonga and got to look in the eye of this baby humpback whale, which is one of the most incredible things I think that anyone could ever do on this planet. And afterwards, just sitting on the boat, so emotional, I just had this realization that, oh, the facts and the sad parts of life aren't that motivating. Like, what's motivating for me is this connection and feeling that love for that one baby whale. Like, I just had this moment of like, I'm going to keep working on ocean conservation and fighting for this for the rest of my life for that one whale, regardless of everything else. So it kind of changed how I thought about things, and I started to move away from science and depressing statistics and towards trying to foster that love in other people. So now I mostly work as a guide, and I try wherever I can to do these presentations and reach different groups and connect people to animals or places, or help them to start those connections or build on their own connections, because I think that's ultimately the best tool we have for conservation. I think people protect what they love, and often they don't realize what's out there, how precious it is, how fragile it is. But by showing them things, teaching them things, showing them how amazing everything is, hopefully they connect to it, they would care about it, they want to save it. That's the general idea.
Yes, that is sweet. And it's been working out for you?
I think so. Yeah, I think it's always hard to know. I think that's one of the hardest things with conservation. You can put so much effort into something and you don't really know the impact, because often it can ripple out. Or at least I like to think that, and you never really know who you're reaching. They never really come back and tell you. So I have had some people have told me like, oh, I had this experience and afterwards I changed my behavior. So I guess on that level it works. There's been really interesting studies. Actually, there was one in Tonga a few years ago where they surveyed people before and after they swam with whales, and they showed that people after they swam with whales were more likely to do things like remember to take their bag to the supermarket instead of using a plastic bag. So there's been some studies kind of just starting to show those behavior changes. There's not a lot out there yet, but they do exist. So I like to think it works, if only to make myself feel better about the state of the planet.
Yeah.
What do you think? I feel like you do events kind of like that as well. Like what you're doing in the Tarkine is really similar. It's just in the trees instead of in the ocean. You feel like it works?
Oh, 100%. Yeah, like it definitely. And, it does. For sure. If you can facilitate, like you say, that experience or that ability to connect people to back to the natural world, then I feel like it might be a longer process for some people, but you're always planting seeds. Like you're always planting seeds, and that sometimes they take a little bit longer to really kind of take off in people. I think one of the other things too is just it's so much healthier to be out in nature or out in the wilder world, outdoors, full stop, and having conversation with people. You know, I think those two things together, you just can't beat that for general health. And when people are healthier, they understand what gives them better health and more vitality and a better feeling of life. And then, you know, humans are somewhat smart sometimes. Sometimes it appears not, but you know, you can join the dots pretty quickly when that kind of thing starts to, when you're able to be in those experiences and those situations. And I totally think it works. And I just have so much fun doing it that at the end of the day, you know, like I'm just going to keep doing it anyway because it's just so rad.
Yeah. And there are actually loads of studies showing, I don't know if you've ever read Blue Mind, It's a very ocean-focused one, but it shows that the ocean, even just looking at the ocean, is good for your health, physical health, not just mental health. It showed that like people that even just had a picture of the ocean healed faster than people that didn't have a picture of the ocean in their rooms, for example. So there's all of these ways it physically does make it healthier. And I think often taking that step from normal life into trying to live a more sustainable life is such a luxury. But if people aren't healthy and aren't in that headspace, it's not something that's ever going to happen. So getting that, yeah, that space, that peace, that mental health, that physical health, whatever it is from coming from nature, is critical on a fundamental level for people to be able to take that next step to being stewards or custodians or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah. And so, and I think actually our good friend of ours, mutual friend M. Toner, has always said, you know, like, if you can put so much into trying to protect the natural and wild world, but you've also got to look after yourself, like, you're only going to be as beneficial to, you know, protecting these wild places if you're also looking after yourself. And I think that speaks a little bit to what you're saying too, hey? Yeah.
Definitely. Yeah, I think M is preaching a message that everyone needs to hear on that front. I think it's pretty cool. I think a lot of the time in the conservation movement, you see people burning out because it is hard. Like at the end of the day, it's one step forward and 10 step backward a lot of the time with a lot of these issues and movements. So it's really hard. So it's really important you look after yourself, because otherwise you're going to burn out. You're not going to be useful to anyone or anything. So it's critical you look after yourself, I think.
Totally, totally. And we were just saying before, actually, like, but it's so fucking wholesome. Like, it just, when you get, when you're trying and when you get small wins, it's just like the best. You just like, I feel like, and I was, you know, I can't really articulate, but maybe it's got some connection with like, yes, like, because you're not just doing something for yourself and your community and the community of, say, wild places that surround it, like, but you're doing something for generations away, and I can't help but think that plays a part in the feeling of wholesomeness and just freaking stoke that you get when you're doing something good for the planet.
Totally. And I think it's something that Indigenous people have known for a long time, and we're just slowly coming to the realization that actually it feels really good to look after your life support system and to look after this planet that gives you so much. Like, it gives us literally like the air we're breathing, the food we're eating, the water. Everyone we know exists here. Like, there's so much the planet gives us and the environment gives us and nature gives us. It just feels so good to be able to give something back. So I think that's also a real good driver. You see something incredible or something really touches you and you're like, oh, I get to help that place or that animal. It feels amazing.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Hey, so I you've done a lot of study in like marine biology and you said before, like plastic pollution and things like that, a lot of science, a lot of research. But what is it that that kind of, you know, Indigenous people and First Nations people have taught you about the ocean that science and all the study in books hasn't or couldn't?
Oh, so much. I feel like years ago I went to this little presentation in Sydney when I was at uni, and it was at the Sydney Institute of Marine Science, and they were talking, they had different speakers, and I can't remember any of them except this one lady who'd come from Hawaii, and she was talking about how in Hawaii at her university they now had a degree where it joined like modern science and Indigenous knowledge. So they looked at things like stories of this type of tree flowers at this time of year, and that's when you know that the coral will be spawning, and this is happening and this is happening, and it's just known by the people that have been connected to that land for so long. But a lot of that knowledge was completely ignored by science for so long and just disregarded. And so hearing her speak about how this university, which is like the top of the pile for ignoring Indigenous knowledge and saying our way of thinking is the only right way, I was so stoked to hear that they were marrying those two things together. And I think that doesn't happen in many places, unfortunately. But it's great that it's starting there. Hopefully it spreads to more places. But I think that we just have so much to learn on that practical level, but in a bigger sense on a, I don't even know what the word would be, a more general level in just how we interact with the ocean. basically. So just understanding that the ocean is not there for us to take from, and it's not there for us to eat as much as we want or to fish as much as we want or to put our waste into. It's there first, and we depend on it. So kind of flipping that relationship on its head, instead of the ocean providing for us, we need to provide for the ocean, because it's the biggest thing. It's the most important thing. Like, without that healthy ocean, everything we know dies. And life will continue in some way. Like, there's creatures living in volcanic vents at the bottom of the ocean that aren't going to care about anything going on up here. But for humans to survive, for everyone we love to survive, for future generations, we need that ocean to be healthy. And so I think that Indigenous knowledge of caring for the planet that sustains us and seeing us ourselves as custodians is what we need to learn. And I think also looking at that kind of negative versus positive view of conservation. So I guess the dark facts versus the idea of connecting to places. For me, that Indigenous viewpoint helped me to shift how I thought about conservation and my role, because it went from feeling guilty all the time and feeling like, oh, we're just kind of parasites on this planet, which is an easy view to take. I think if you look at what we're doing with fossil fuels and the climate and all these issues, it's easy to think that humans, our species, is kind of just a parasite on the planet. And I think ultimately that's an unhealthy way to think, definitely not good for your self-love and self-image, and ultimately pretty depressing. And then shifting to being like, no, we're custodians, and our role here is to look after these wild places and protect them. And we've seen in other places that that works. And there's so much to learn in that sense, I think, about shifting how we view ourselves and our role.
Damn straight. I couldn't put it better myself. And I truly appreciate and respect your opinion on that. And I 100%, if you ever need to get that message out there a little bit more, you just give me a shout and I'll happily echo your thoughts on that.
Yes, thanks.
And how about within Australia, like in the Australian world? Like, have you had the pleasure of being on country with some of the traditional owners and learnt story from them and ways that you've been able to incorporate into your life on how to better interact with the places that we call home?
Yeah, definitely. Not as much as I would have liked. Where I grew up was kind of northwest New South Wales in the country. It's a very, very divided town. It's called Moree. I don't know if you've ever heard of it. Very small town, cotton country, and some beautiful things out there, but also very famously known for being segregated well up until about the 80s. So it has a very dark history and still today is a really just quite racist town. So growing up there, that was my input of, I don't know, I guess Indigenous relations. And then when I left there, it wasn't until probably I went to boarding school and it was probably like my first year there that I was suddenly like, oh, I have all these, like, I'm a really racist person. And I didn't even know, because that was just my whole community. And it was mind blowing to me to reach places and be like, oh, this way of thinking is not okay. Like, it was just, yeah, to start questioning it and be like, oh, that's, yeah, the way that a lot of people in my life have always thought and taught me is actually not a correct way of thinking. So that was a big learning curve for me at the age of 12 to see that, yeah, everything, the way I'd seen a lot of people, was completely wrong. So then later in life, it's been really great to meet people and learn from them on country. Has been amazing. So I did some work in Western Australia. I don't know if you've been around Esperance, in the national parks there. I was really lucky to be doing some seabird research on the islands off Esperance, on the Research Archipelago. And as part of that, I was traveling with a team of archaeologists who were working with the traditional owners to look at the traditional history along that coastline. So we just got to go and hike and camp in the national parks and look for artifacts. And it was amazing, partially to just learn all of this archaeology and history, but also just to be like, oh, here is a situation where this town works and everyone cooperates and the knowledge of the traditional owners is valued. And it was just so cool to see that there was a different way of living that worked. That was really great. And then in Byron, we're really lucky to have quite a few amazing traditional owners who are super knowledgeable. So I've got a beautiful friend, Jambi, who's part of our freediving community, and it's always amazing to go out with him because I feel like a lot of the time he can explain things that you can feel but don't really understand why. Like one of my favorite freediving sites has always felt like just the most sacred and incredible place in the world. It's called Julian Rocks. Did you get out there while you were in Byron?
I did not, no.
No? Okay. Next time you come visit, I will take you out there. And it's just a special place. It's just these two rocks about 2 km offshore, I guess, just sticking up out of the water. It doesn't look like much, but freediving there is amazing. And you always see incredible things. I've had amazing freedives there with manta rays just hanging in the current, and they'll just let you swim like right under them and they just hang and stare at you. Big flocks of eagle rays. Sometimes you get 30 leopard sharks, this beautiful long spotty shark that just cruise again in the currents, and just, oh, it's so beautiful. And it just feels sacred in the way that some wild places just sometimes feel. And yeah, I've always felt that. And one day I was out there with Jambi and he told me that actually there's a little cave at Julian Rocks, and thousands of years ago it would have been above the water level and people could get out there, and that cave was sacred to ceremony. And he told me that the creator spirit in our area, the Bundjalung Nation, actually is called Nathangali, and Nathangali comes down and into that cave during his time on Earth. So it's a really, really, really sacred spot and kind of where the whole Dreamtime story starts in our area. So I just thought that was amazing to find like this really incredible explanation of why it feels so special, because it is. It's this really sacred spot.
Oh, yeah. I have to say, like, that brings up a lot of, kind of feeling and emotion, because I've definitely been lucky enough to experience something similar, you know, just having that feeling but not really having any way to articulate it or any reason to for it to feel such a way, except that it's just, you know, nature and it's awesome. But so sweet.
Yeah, it was pretty special.
I think it kind of brings me on to ask a little bit about like your knowledge and thoughts on and what you think we need to do in regards to environmental inclusivity going forward. And how that plays a role in especially the work that you do. So, I just want to hear your thoughts on that and how we can, because I don't think it's a term that really gets used in everyone's circles a lot, but I still feel like environmental inclusivity is definitely something that is that we kind of need to speak about and need to bring awareness to. So how does it play a role in your way about doing things?
I think it's one of the things that really gives me so much hope, because I've really seen in the last few years in particular that the whole concept of like intersectional environmentalism or environmental inclusivity, or this idea of different groups that are united around the same cause, I think it's just really taken off. I don't know if it's just that I've suddenly woken up to it, but I feel like I just see it everywhere now. And I think a few years ago it was much more divided, and it was like these people are fighting for these issues, like these people are fighting for the trees, these people are fighting for the dolphins, these people are fighting for black rights, these people are fighting whatever it is. But I think in the last few years, like, that Black Lives Matter movement has brought everything to the fore, which has been amazing. But I think also it's become part of this bigger movement where everyone's realized that this is not about just police brutality and it's not about just unfair laws, but it's about creating a system that oppresses people, and we're all in it together. And so it's about looking at how, like, the climate movement, for example, disproportionately impacts people of color. But so it's kind of part of the same fight almost. I don't know if I'm explaining that right, but it feels like it's become this bigger movement where everyone has joined together and gone, it's not about these individual issues. We're all fighting for the same thing. We're all fighting for a planet that is fair for everyone, that's livable, where we protect our natural resources, where everyone has enough of what they need. And that includes the animals, the plants. Like, it's that idea of, yeah, everyone coming together. Paul Hawken wrote a really great book about it called Blessed Unrest. And he talked about how we're in the middle of the biggest social movement that ever happened, but we don't really see it because it's not got an ideology or a centralized leader. But it's lots of small grassroots movements happening all around the world and fighting for, like, women's rights in Guatemala, but that's essentially fighting for the same cause as me fighting to protect a place from fracking off my coastline here in Western Australia. But we're fighting for the same thing. And it's just that social and environmental justice. So yeah, that's where I'm at with it. It just gives me a lot of hope to think that now it's starting to unify and we're realizing that it's a global fight for everyone and not necessarily one specific issue.
Yeah, we're all on like that one front, but have those individual reasons to be there. Totally. Like the amount of times I've seen, so like, yeah, you can't have environmental justice without social justice. And when you put those two things together, it's like, it's a no-brainer. Of course you can't. Like, yeah. And so what is it that we can do in our small world where, say, you know, I'm looking at helping protect sections of land, but what is the social injustice that also comes with that, you know? And, yeah, it's awesome that is becoming, like you say, like a bigger movement. That's a really interesting way of putting it. I haven't heard that. What was that book called again?
It's called Blessed Unrest by Paul Hawkins.
Sweet. Yeah,
it's a few years old now, but I feel like it's still super relevant and or even more relevant, really. And also I think intersectional environmentalism, anything on intersectional environment, but I think it captures that whole idea really well.
Yeah, nice. And so to come back and have a little bit more of a chat about your own personal journey. How did you go from that where you grew up that you explained previously, and how did you get to like where you are, and how did you choose the things that you're so passionate about, or how did they choose you and you came to be aware of it? Like, did things happen along the way that were real kind of moving moments for you in that sense?
Yeah, it was a bit of a journey because where I grew up was very different from where I am now. And I think it took me a long time to get here. I don't think I was a kid with a goal of being a marine biologist. And I definitely had no idea that I could have a job where people pay me to be swimming in the ocean every day with animals that are really cool. I had no concept of that existing. But I think I ended up here. Who even knows? I kind of did a lot of traveling when I was younger. When I finished high school, I didn't know what I wanted to do. So I just took off overseas and then just backpacked for a really long time, about 5 years just working and traveling. And along the way, just partied a lot, but also did some really great things, like some volunteering in different places. And that's where I started to find the things that I loved. And it was kind of a reminder of like, oh, yeah. Like I volunteered on this sea turtle project and it reminded me like, oh yeah, when I was a kid, I loved turtles and this actually makes me so happy. And then I met really amazing people that just had so much knowledge. And I remember chatting to them while I was eating like my canned tuna and drinking out of a plastic bottle and them saying like, oh, actually, you know, that canned tuna, not really that good for the sea turtles that we're trying to protect. And just thinking, how has no one told me this? How have I gotten this far in life and not knowing that my canned tuna is seabird or sea turtle or shark friendly, and why hasn't anyone told me that these plastic bottles are so bad? And just being shocked and then going, what else don't I know? And I think that's what started it. And then it was just like this vicious cycle of learning more and then having to change so many things in my life, which at times can be challenging when you're trying to avoid plastic and trying to only eat vegan and traveling and feeling this deep guilt about your carbon footprint all the time. Now I've ended up living in this way that is as simple as I think I can live. So we live in a grid tiny house. It's all on solar and rainwater. And I think there was a few key people that I met along the way that taught me bits and pieces and showed me how much I did know. And then, had to keep learning and learning. And then once you start, it's impossible to stop because so many cool things to learn about the ocean.
Yeah. And once you know, you know, right? And it's pretty hard to turn back when you are, you know what's going on. So yeah, the people that you met is a huge thing, obviously, like through your travels. And I wanted to find out, like, what are some of the research and volunteer and projects that you've been on that really kind of created a motivation for you to make a change and not just make a change in your own personal life, but then to communicate the ability to do that to others?
I think my work with plastic was really that tipping point, because I'd done research, a little bit of research on whales, which was amazing and what I would love to be doing full time. But then when I started doing the plastic research, this was probably about 10 years ago, and it just felt like I was learning all of these things, and there was already a lot of research out there, but no one knew about it. And so I think that's what really pushed me into feeling like, well, I have to do this. Like, I have to get involved, do more research, and I have to start communicating the science to people, because it no one knew. And so I'd be doing like these cleanups and picking up lots of trash, and people would be like, oh, that sucks, you know, drinking out of their plastic bottles. And a lot of cafes would not take my reusable cup. Where I was living in Manly, pretty much no one would take a reusable cup. They just, like, it was not sanitary apparently back then, and just all these things. And I felt like, oh, this is too big a problem to be quiet about. And so that's when I started doing school talks and presentations at different places. And so that was really it for me. And then I think it's now shifted into also doing more like the art workshop, and I do presentations on whales and things now. And I think now it's shifted more, especially with the guiding, into teaching people about the environment and the amazing parts of nature, and not just the negative impacts we're having. But at the start, it was really just this desperate feeling of like, we have to do something, just wanting to like shake everybody and tell them like, this issue is too big, it's gonna kill everything.
But it's huge. It's, I mean, and it hasn't changed, like, it's still massive, right?
And definitely, and increasing, unfortunately. Plastic production still massively on the up.
Yeah, absolutely. And so what is the message that you want to get out to people about it?
Just that you cannot understate how huge the plastic problem is. I think it's up there with climate change. It's probably the biggest threat facing our planet right now, because it's so pervasive. We've all seen those videos and those images of animals tangled in trash and beaches covered in trash, and you kind of almost get used to those images. But what we don't see is the microplastics, which are probably even a bigger threat. So the big pieces of plastic can entangle animals, can harm animals in that way. But the big problem is they break down into smaller pieces, and those smaller pieces never go away. So there's literally more pieces of microplastic in our ocean than there are stars in our galaxy. We're increasing plastic production every day. And most of the things,
Ben. I knew it. Ben, yeah, hang on. Let's sit. Wait a second. So there's more, because I have heard, and I'm not going to be cozy of this to clarify, but I've heard that there's like more stars in our sky, in our galaxies, whatever, than there is grains of sand in the world. Right. So if we just think about that.
I should know that. That's sand related, but I don't know the sand one, but definitely I know there's more microplastic than stars. So,
and so I'm just going to, my mind's getting blown up right now. Sorry I interrupted you. I just had to, take a moment before you went on.
Let's hammer that home some more. There is so much out there.
Okay.
There's some research I worked on a few years ago that showed there was over 5 trillion pieces just in the top 10 centimetres of the ocean. And that was likely to be a massive underestimate. And since then, that has only hugely increased, because that research probably is 6 or 7 years old now. So the amount in our oceans is just, you can't even comprehend it, basically. There's so much in there. And it never goes away, because it's a man-made product. Nothing in nature can break it down. So it just gets smaller and smaller and smaller. And then it becomes really, really dangerous, basically. So the plastic in our oceans is like a sponge for harmful pollutants. So anything that's in the ocean, things like DDT or pesticides that we don't even use anymore, but they're at trace levels in the ocean, they can attach to the plastic, heavy metal. Plus, there's all these chemicals the plastics are inherently made with. They're made with a lot of really terrible things. So then you have these little like toxic pellets essentially floating around. And when they get eaten by animals, which they do, they get eaten by everything in the ocean. They're filter fed by coral, whales. They're eaten by everything. And then those pollutants can move into the food chain. And so then you've got all of these chemicals getting transferred into all of these animals and also people. So it's estimated that the average seafood eater eats about a credit card a week worth of little bits of plastic along with their seafood. That's mostly physical pieces in things like filter feeding small animals like oysters and mussels. But even if you're not eating the tiny physical pieces, you're likely getting those pollutants, which is a big issue. And then they've even started to show really scary things with the nanoplastics, which are the really, really, really tiny ones that can actually move, for example, from the blood into cells and into tissue. So they've shown tiny bits of plastic like moving around the body even and into different parts of the body. They've shown like human immune system response to tiny bits of plastic in cells. So it's just there's so many ways that it harms animals and harms people. And we're just starting to understand, I think, the breadth of that threat. So it's a huge issue. But as depressing and terrifying it is to think that we've literally filled up our planet with trash. So it's at the bottom of the deepest ocean. It's frozen into the Arctic sea ice. Like the plastic is everywhere. It's on every beach in the world. It's in a lot of what we're eating. It's in sea salt. So a lot of our table salt has plastic in it. It's in a lot of beer. They've shown has microplastic in it. It's everywhere. They've shown it in newborn placentas. However, I think the really amazing thing about plastic and the message that I really want to hammer home is that we already have all the solutions that we need to fix the problem. It's just a matter of getting those rolling. And a lot of them are happening. It is snowballing and we are moving in the right direction. And a generation ago, we didn't have this reliance on single-use plastic because the issue here is making these products that we throw away out of a material that lasts forever. And a generation ago, that didn't happen. The plastics industry has made this genius invention of teaching us all to throw this product away when it's actually a really valuable, useful product. And so they've kind of brainwashed us all, but we can take that power back. And within a generation, I'm really confident we could turn it around again and not have single-use plastics. And there's legislation taking off around the world that is banning a lot of those harmful single-use plastics. And if we keep pushing, I'm really confident we can turn this around. So I think ultimately it's a happy story, a scary story, but it has the potential to have a happy ending if we all just keep pushing. So individual changes, like getting rid of single-use plastic as much as you can in your life, but also community change, government-level change, business-level change is a really big one. So Patagonia has been really at the fore with that because they invested a lot of money into finding alternatives to the clothes that shed microfibers. So, for example, one polyester jacket, like what you would wear hiking, one wash can shed over 7,000 microfibers, which is individual tiny little shreds of plastic. So Patagonia joined up with a lot of other big outdoor companies like Arc'teryx, REI, to fund research into how can we stop that from happening, basically. And at the moment, we don't have a silver bullet answer. There's not really a good solution. There's lots of little patchy solutions that we can do that are definitely worth doing. But ultimately, it needs to happen at a big level. It needs to happen with those businesses and those governments. So that's what we need to keep fighting for. But it is happening. So my main message. It turned out quite long.
No, it's freaking motivating. It's great. And so the so pressure on businesses and governments is is a possible thing to do.
Yeah, it's a great thing to do. Huge thing to do. Yeah, don't underestimate how much impact you can have. It doesn't take much for a business to pay attention to people not buying their stuff, basically. They've done studies and they've shown it could be as low as like a few percent change or a few percent of the population putting that pressure on, and it leads to large-scale change.
Yeah. And you can do things like actually just kind of voice your opinion to them directly. Is that possible?
Yeah, which is so easy these days. Yeah. Things like Twitter, great, call them out. I say like Instagram, social media, call them out and tell them what you're thinking. You can send them emails, contact them directly, because if they hear from enough people, then they start to care about it. Most companies at the end of the day are designed to make a profit. And if that profit's being impacted because people say, I'm not buying your stuff because it's killing the ocean, it's killing us, then they will start to look at alternatives.
Yeah. It's funny, social media, I was listening to a chat with the great Sean Doherty, and he was yarning about this is on the Water People's podcast with Dave and Lauren, and he was yarning about the Fight for the Bike campaign and how Equinor, the huge oil and gas company, was was their social media like accounts. They like shut down for a year because they were getting so hammered with comments and engagement from the community, negative engagement more so than anything.
Yeah.
And they just never had to deal with that. And you think how powerful social media can be for a business and you know, to be able to shut it down through community feedback, essentially, is huge and so powerful. And yeah, it kind of just made me think, well, like it's legit. You can have, or you can connect with people in those, because people have to monitor those accounts and those avenues of communication with the public. Yeah.
And I think there's a lot of anti-clicktivism, like where people say, oh, it doesn't make any difference if you sign the online petition or you call someone out on Instagram. But I think it's as part of a bigger movement. At the end of the day, if all you're doing is signing online petitions, it's probably not enough. Like there's too much happening right now. There are too many issues on the planet for that to be enough. It needs to go hand in hand with other things, like changing things in your own life, doing what you can in your community, talking to your local cafe about switching out their plastic straws or whatever it is. There's so many different avenues you can do. And I think coming back to that self-care, it's important not to go, I'm responsible for fixing this whole planet and it's on my shoulders, which is often how a lot of us feel, I think. And that is very unhelpful. Easy to do, but unhelpful. But I think it is just going, well, what can I do? What things can I do in my life that will make a positive difference? And just doing those things. So simple.
And they can be so small too, right? Like,
yeah.
Yeah. They don't, yeah, you, like you said, you don't have to change it all at once. But I mean, it just blows my mind, hey, how people continually use disposable items, like be it cups or plastic bags or like packaging is a huge one, you just have all sorts. It's just like, and don't get me wrong, like I find myself doing it too, but like, I mean, not takeaway cups, like fuck me, I'll skip a coffee if I have to use a takeaway cup. Like I'm just, I freaking don't love it that much. And a good bit of fresh air and a couple of push-ups will wake you up more than a cup of coffee any day, I'd have to say. But I mean, anyway, I'm not trying to beat up on people who do it, but I am in some ways, true.
I definitely get what you're saying. I think it's kind of this balance of like the plastic companies ultimately are the ones that benefit from us feeling really guilty, because then often people are like, well, fuck it, it's too hard, I'm not even going to try. And I think that's not where you want to get to. But, yeah, definitely say no to a coffee instead of using a plastic cup. Like, of course, what kind, like we're so privileged to just think I can consume all these things and not think about it. So, yeah, at the end of the day, it is finding what you can do. And also it is a privilege to be able to say, okay, I live in a society where I can afford to spend maybe a couple of dollars extra on my milk than I would normally spend because I buy it in little glass jars and then blend it up with water to make my milk to avoid using the cartons. Like, so privileged to be able to do that. It's ridiculous. And I don't think that's something everyone is going to be able to do, which is also why you need all those different facets, because I can do that. Amazing. I'm going to do it. For the people that can't, I need to keep pushing for the companies to design better products and for the government to legislate to ban those stupid cartons that can't be recycled. So it has to keep coming at all those different levels.
What, you can't recycle milk cartons?
Nope, unrecyclable. Because they're like cardboard and plastic all just smushed together. Yeah.
I think that might be the biggest fact you've dropped the whole session.
Sorry. Yeah, they've got that little, the little chasing arrow symbol means nothing, basically. It's fancy marketing. The chasing arrows mean nothing. The numbers inside the chasing arrows are what you've got to look for. But even then, of the recyclable plastic, globally less than 10% of recyclable plastics are recycled. So recycling is not really the solution.
No.
Not using them in the first place.
It's freaking reducing, like reducing. Mm. Put on your brakes. You know, one thing I thought and I feel like is really interesting, kind of speaking of symbols and things like that and numbers, it's like, you know, on and I know you've got the answer to this is why I'm asking you. I hope you do anyway. Uh-oh. I'm pretty sure. But
we do.
It's so incredible because, you know, like for so long we trudged around the world and whatnot growing up and you never saw anything about BPA. Like nothing was any – like nothing. But now everywhere you see BPA free. Oh, hey, this bottle's BPA free. This is BPA free.
Yeah.
But like, what's so bad about BPA?
Phew, I do know the answer to this. Great question. So BPA, bisphenol A, is one of those plastic additives. So remember before I was saying the plastic is made with a lot of potentially harmful things. BPA is one of those, and it's one of a whole suite of chemicals that are added. So when the plastic is made, it's basically chemistry, things mush together to make the plastic, and then they add things to make it flexible or colourful or fireproof or all these different things. So BPA is one of those, and I'm fairly sure it was BPA that was originally designed as a hormone mimicker, like as an estrogen. So I think it was going to be given to women for something, birth control, something in that area, and then that didn't work, got shelved. And so later they were like, oh, but if we put this in plastic, it makes it flexy. So that's a really good thing to add to plastic. Little did they know that the plastic then leaches that BPA. So basically, I'm not a chemist, but a very basic understanding of it is when the plastic is made and those additives are put in, they're less firmly bonded to the plastic than the original chemical process that made the plastic. So the additives leach out easily. So that's especially when things are heated or if they're floating around in the ocean for a long time. So the BPA is one of those. Phthalates is another one you might have heard of with the funny spelling, P-T-H-A-L-A-T-E-S. And the phthalates are another thing that I think softens the plastic. The flame retardants are another really harmful one. So things like PBDE or polybrominated diphenyl ethers. Just thought I'd throw that in there to sound impressive. So all these things are added to the plastic and all of them can potentially cause a lot of really scary impacts on humans. The BPA has gotten a lot of media because it was really obvious side effect. And it's interesting that it's become a big thing now because if you read the research on it since like the 80s even, there's been papers published showing BPA really messes with your endocrine system, so your hormones basically. So BPA is an endocrine disruptor. So particularly on fetuses, it has the biggest impact, so developing babies. The BPA can cause a whole suite of developmental issues. One really terrifying one, which you could ecosia if you want to be really scared, is called hyperspadias, which is basically in boys, this is just an awful one, where the hole in the penis develops in the wrong spot. Maybe don't ecosia it. It's really gory. And that's caused by their hormone system being disrupted while they're developing. So they develop wrong, basically. And that's one of many, 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 many impacts, but probably the scariest looking one. So the BPA got a lot of press because it caused so many negative impacts and it was so obvious. A lot of these other chemicals, it's a little bit more hidden. But basically, people have been rallying for decades to get BPA out of plastic and out of things that people are using. And now it's finally getting some traction. But as with a lot of things in the chemical industry, I guess, they have to be proven harmful rather than proven safe. So they can pretty much put anything out there and then we have to prove that it's bad to get it taken away. So that's how things like tobacco get such a strong foothold because people, again, for decades were like, well, this tobacco is killing people. And then the tobacco industry has a lot of money to lobby and say, no, it's fine. And that's exactly what happens with the plastic industry. So the plastic industry, all of the big producers of plastic have these big groups basically that they put millions and millions of dollars into to do things like try and hide that research on BPA and block legislation. So for example, in the Northern Territory, when they brought in a 10-cent refund on bottles and cans, Coca-Cola sued the Northern Territory government trying to get rid of that legislation. So there's huge amounts of money put into trying to keep us all consuming all this single-use plastic. So BPA has finally got some traction and finally is getting removed from quite a lot of things. What they're putting in instead of the BPA, couldn't tell you. Legally, they don't have to tell us what they're putting in the plastic. May or may not be as harmful as BPA. And even without the BPA, there's still lots of other potentially harmful chemicals in there. So BPA free, whenever I see it, always kind of makes me laugh because I'm like, well, what else is in there? It's just this one chemical that's kind of got some news. But in general, anything that is soft, any plastic you can squish, has chemicals in there to make them do that. So it's likely that they're leaching out. It's like if you've ever drunk water that's been in a plastic bottle in the car for a few days and it has that gross taste, you can actually taste those chemicals leaching into the water. So your own personal health, and particularly people that want to have kids, their health, is a really good reason, even if you don't care about the planet and the sea turtles with the straws in their nose, just for your own personal health, it's a really good idea to avoid single-use plastics. So things like takeaway food containers, very bad for your health. Any food packaging, really, that's touching your food is not ideal. Coffee cups, great example. They've got that lining of plastic on the inside that's just leaching stuff into your coffee. So it's your own health at the end of the day that's impacted if you keep using all those single-use plastics.
Freaking nailed it. Yes.
Oh, what a relief that I knew the answer.
I set you up on that one. I definitely knew you had the answer. But that is incredible, hey? Like, because you see that, like, everywhere. It's just like it's been used now as a marketing tool. BPA-free, amazing. Mm-hmm. This is so good for you now. Like, but that is some incredible insight to the system that's operating at the moment and what we face with our choices. It's unreal.
Mm. Yeah, it's similar to the bioplastics and the compostable plastics. It's kind of another, essentially all just greenwashing. So it's kind of giving people what they want to hear. But at the end of the day, like all of those bioplastic coffee cups, they don't compost. They just fracture into smaller pieces faster usually. If they end up in the ocean or in a park, they have the same impacts as plastic. There are a very small amount of compostable plastics that can be composted, like in a backyard compost. But even most compostable plastics have to be an industrial compost, which don't exist in most council areas. And even if they do, who gets their trash into those through the waste stream? Like, where are you putting it that it's getting into an industrial compost? Definitely not in a bin on the side of the road. So, yeah, unfortunately, the bioplastics, I think, are another big field where hopefully one day in the future we'll have it down and things that have to be single use can be bioplastic that is eventually compostable. But at the moment, it's just a big greenwashing campaign in a lot of ways.
Hmm. So where do you spend time, or like what resources do you use to keep up to date on this like system of the world?
It's a good question, because I think it's hard to find that balance between trying to find the knowledge and getting massively depressed about the state of the world. It's a good question. I feel like a lot of the things I know about plastic are just from years of researching it. So it was a lot of like reading journal articles and compiling that information as part of that process of science. So I'm glad I don't have to do that again. I feel like when I was doing that, I was a very sad person for about a year when I was doing my own research and learning all of that. And in a broader sense, I think I just read a lot of books, basically. I'm a big book reader, and I find authors that I like or topics that I like and just get really obsessed with reading about them, basically.
What are your top five book recommendations?
Oh, that's such a hard question. I feel like I would have to sit down and think about it.
I mean, cool. We can do top 20. That's fine too.
So many. I've just been reading, in terms of ocean nerdy books, I've just been reading Helen Scales, one of her latest books, and she's a scientist, a marine scientist, who writes books about very specific but very interesting topics. So she did one called Eye of the Shoal, which is all about fish and fish intelligence and fish communication. Brilliant. The one I just read is called Spirals in Time, and it's about mollusks and seashells and how they evolve. Also brilliant. Another really good ocean one is Other Minds, which is probably everyone's seen My Octopus Teacher by now, so everyone knows how cool octopus are. Other Minds is by a philosopher who looks at how consciousness evolved, obviously, with us, and we're in the same group as primates, dolphins, elephants, lots of other animals that have consciousness. But our common ancestor with octopus is a really long time ago and was definitely not a conscious animal. And so he basically explores this idea of consciousness evolving twice on the planet, because it evolved for us and all of our similar animals, but octopus also evolved consciousness independently of us, which is amazing and so mind-blowing. So he explores that and how we know octopus are conscious and how many other animals might be conscious, but how our view of what makes intelligence is very limited to our own intelligence. And so we're probably missing a lot of what goes on. That's a great one. There's so many. They're all just like bouncing around in my brain right now. They're ones I've read recently. Braiding Sweetgrass. That's one of my top three, I reckon. Have you read Braiding Sweetgrass?
I have not, but I have. This is like the second time this week it's popped up, actually, which is saying something.
That happened to me. It just kept popping up and I was like, fine, I'll read it. And then it just is so beautiful. And I think particularly touching on what we were talking about earlier with that Indigenous knowledge, oh, it's so amazing. She's a scientist, a PhD botanist, studies plants and plant use, but also comes from a Native American, I can't remember the name of her tribe, but probably I couldn't pronounce it properly anyway. And so she, Robin Kimmerer, who wrote this book, weaves the different things together. So like stories and science and Indigenous knowledge. And it's just the most beautiful book. And I feel like it really shifted how I thought a little bit as well, because I kind of before was like, yeah, of course, Indigenous knowledge is really great and they know a lot. But reading her book really just made me, I guess, feel it more deeply and more consciously. And also I think it kind of changed how I would like to communicate. I would like to communicate more like her, because she does just, yeah, weave beautiful knowledge with story so well. So everyone should read that.
Awesome. Yeah, I will. I'm not going to make any promises because I've got about 9,000 books that I've been recommended to read. But I will do something about reading or listening to Braiding's Sweetgrass.
It's so good. Okay, now you have to give me a book recommendation. I'm going to throw you in the hot seat because it's really stressful.
I'm reading one at the moment called The Monkey Wrench Gang. And
oh, I feel like I read that years ago. Is it about like the activists?
Yeah, yeah. They're just it's a group of people that are just like going hell for leather to protect to stop mining companies and stuff like that. And it's just, I don't even know. I think it's got to be fiction. Yeah. Anyway, they just like go around blowing up train lines and driving bulldozers off cliffs. And it's like hardcore activism. And it's just so funny. Yeah.
Awesome.
So anyway, yeah, the Monkey book. Wrench Gang. It's just, yeah. It's
Does it
kind
make
of,
you feel inspired to go and blow some shit up?
I can't say that publicly.
That's probably wise.
Yeah, it's a nice spin on things. Totally. Hey, I know how you feel now being put on the spot about a book recommendation. But
because there's so many good ones and I feel like my mind just goes blank. I'm like, oh God, there's so many I want to recommend, but I can't think of any.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, yeah, Start With Why is a huge one that I feel really, really moved by. The power of now is just unreal. It's unreal. So
that is really good.
Yeah.
Start With Why. Is that the one you just said? I haven't read that one. I'm going to write that down.
Yeah, it's cool. It's really, it's a really great way to understand like a foundation which you can really live purposely from, I feel. Yeah, and understand what your why is, like why you do anything. And then, yeah, it's just so, so good.
So useful.
I feel like, you know, you've really been able to tap into that in the work that you do. Like you definitely feel sound and so passionate and so connected with the work that you do. It feels like you get a lot of purpose out of it. Would that be like a correct summary of it?
Yeah, definitely. I feel like I wish I'd read a book like that maybe like 5 or 6 years ago and I could have got here sooner, but I feel like somehow I've stumbled along and ended up, yeah, in a place where I feel really grateful every day that I get to do something I really love and I get to feel like I'm making a positive difference with what I'm doing.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing.
So good.
And wild. Like just, yeah, so lucky. I don't know how I got here, but it's great.
And so what would your like... As we wrap it up, what would be your final call to action for people out there?
I think it would be two parts. And part one would be outside and go for a hike or go for a snorkel and find somewhere to feel peace or stillness or stoke or whatever it is that you're looking for, but go and find a place or an animal that just makes you really excited. And yeah, it's that fire burning. And then part two would be just do something. So look at how you can make a difference. Because I think at the end of the day, everybody should use less single-use plastic and do all those things. But I think it ultimately comes down to everyone has something unique to offer. So it's about ending that. Like the Ikigai concept that Japanese have. Do you know Ikigai?
Yeah, like continuous improvement?
More like finding your little spot. So it's got like, it's kind of a Venn diagram. It can easily be summarized in a Venn diagram. What you love, what you're good at, what your community needs. Can't think what the other one is. Maybe it's what the planet needs. But it's basically finding that spot of like the things that you love doing and that you're good at, but also that your community and your whole planet requires, and then putting those together. Because everyone has something amazing and unique to offer, whether it's organizing amazing events in the wild or, I don't know, graphic design or putting out a podcast or a magazine or a book or an amazing drawing that influences how people think or a song, whatever it is. Everybody has something that they're good at and that they can offer. And so it's finding that and looking at what you love, what needs protecting, what needs doing, and then what you have, your unique thing that you can offer to that. And I think that's the best thing everyone should be doing.
And what's the Japanese saying for it?
Ikigai is the concept.
Ikigai. That's cool.
Yeah, like I-K-I-G-A-I. And I'm just going to ikozia it really quick.
Excellent.
And see exactly what it's called. The Japanese concept referring to something that gives a person a sense of purpose or a reason for living.
Ikigai. And
yeah.
And the first one in part one was getting outside.
Hey. Yeah. Get outside, cool. Get stoked on something. Go connect to an animal or a place. Just go find some new birds. Just get outside and enjoy it.
So good. So good. Alice, we're going to leave it at Ikigai and ecosiering Ikigai. So takeaways, awesome. Takeaways from the podcast. You need to ecosia Ikigai. You need to ecosia, yeah. What was the animal? The single-celled animals?
I reckon start with diatoms.
Diatoms
under a microscope. Or just Ernst Haeckel, the artist, to see beautiful drawings of those diatoms.
Awesome. And everyone start ecosiering the shit out of everything.
Yeah, plant all the trees.
Hey, Alice, is there anything else that you want to say? Did we not touch on something that is burning in your heart to yell out?
No, I feel like this is such a fun chat. I've loved it. I feel like it's always hard to just keep talking because I feel like I just want to ask more questions about things. However, I feel like I've ranted enough all day and it's been such a pleasure. I feel like I've touched on so many awesome things.
So, so good. I totally agree with you and I can't thank you enough for everything that you've shared and are going to continue to share and change the world with going forward. So thanks so much, man.
So thanks so much for having me. Oh, I just thought of one thing.
Whoa, that was so lucky.
I just thought
lucky.
Of one other thing that I wanted to add.
Yo,
so lucky you nearly pressed stop, didn't you?
I did.
So I thought of this earlier and then completely forgot about it because we talked about something else. But it's a concept I read about in, it might have been Braiding Sweetgrass or another book from another amazing Indigenous woman from the US, and I might get in confused. Anyway, the concept is the dandelion insurrection. Have you heard of this?
The dandelion what?
Dandelion insurrection.
Dandelion
An
insurrection.
An idea is basically, yeah. So if you think of a dandelion, and you blow it, and those dandelions, and no matter how hard you try, you couldn't go and collect them all back in again. They are gone, and they're going to plant all over the place, and they're going to sprout up into things, and you're never going to know where they end up. And this one idea that came from Standing Rock, that's what I was thinking about, and she was talking about how Standing Rock, that's what it was. All these people came together, and it was this incredible moment, and then they fought against this pipeline. And even though the pipeline got built, she was like, doesn't matter. That's not the point. The point is it was this dandelion insurrection. So after that, the people that were there just spread, and they're sprouting their ideas. They're starting movements all around the world from what they learned and what they saw there. And so I think that's a really good thing to leave it with, that everyone can start these dandelion insurrections where you just put these ideas out, put these movements out there, these actions, and you never know where they're going to spread and what they're going to sprout into. So let's all just be part of the dandelion insurrection.
Oh, Oh, awesome. Oh, Alice, you nailed it, mate. Thank you so much. That is so sick. It goes your
the best. It goes your cozy out of the dandelion direction. It'll make you.
Oh, mate. Thank you so much.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So there we have it, everyone. Homework has been set. I really hope you take the time to reflect back on this podcast, put some of those things into action, and also get out your ecosia and start searching for all the great things that are out there. Let us know how you go. And until next time, and until we can sit in conversation again, I just want to say thank you. Thank you for your time and your energy, and keep well.